Wow, dramatic music and a countdown and everything. This is Tom Shalhoub with Michael Somerville. I'm looking over here because my computer feed is here so I can see you, but I'm not going to look at my computer. I'm going to look at my camera, even though I can't see you, but I'm going to look in the lens and pretend I can see you.
I think that's best. Not spending too much time. It's like looking at the sun. You don't want to look at me too much. I think that's probably best.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Michael Somerville, thanks for joining us. You told me just before going on, we had about 43 seconds before I started recording, and you said that you're kind of a tech phobe. Is that real?
Not phobe, idiot. It's so sad because since the pandemic, you would think we all have a modicum of, like, we can know how to log on and do a podcast. And I just get so stressed if it's not in a thing that I know, you know, like a program. And so, yeah, I never upgrade. So, like, when I was trying to get on this, they were like right away, like, well, you're in 8.0, and we're now using 15 or something. And that scares me. But my wife has a real job, so she's my tech support, but she's not here.
I see. No, wait a minute. What were you lacking? Was it the browser, like Chrome or something?
Those two words came up. Yep. Both those words were used. A format or something. And then at one point, I think it was just like, throw out your computer. One of the messages said, just stop, get a new computer. My computer's got to be 12 years old at this point. I have an iPad that I was trying to use, a pink iPad that I got free from my wife. That didn't work. So then I went to the phone. And all I can say is I can't believe I'm here on time.
Yeah. And you have, is it a phone or a computer?
Right now we're on a laptop. So that was my last resort. I didn't think it was going to work at all, but I don't mean to brag, because to anyone else listening, they're probably like, what's this guy's just dumb. But this was, I was stressed about this for 7 days.
Oh, wow. This is great. Well, it's StreamYard, the technology that I use. I pay them a subscription, and I think they're great. I mean, you use it through your browser, so they want to use Chrome. So some people, they dial up into it, and then it says, oh, you need to do Chrome. You can't do, like, whatever. I can't believe people use other browsers anymore, but they do. And it only works with Chrome and one other one or something like that. So anyway, there's certain requirements. It's everything is like a trade-off, but the good thing about StreamYard is that I can go live. It's a little more functional than Zoom in that I can adjust things. I could do Zoom, but I for some reason I chose StreamYard. So anyway,
I think it's great. But you're exactly right. The Chrome thing, I had to download Chrome. That was the one thing they said, and there was a lot of that going on. But welcome to StreamYard. I love it.
Yeah, StreamYard, it works. So, Michael, let's go back. You know, this is what people like the most. People have the most, when we do these podcasts, people are interested in how these comics that I talk to got started. That's always the thing that they want to know about. So I'm going back to when I met you, we'll say Catch a Rising Star days, which was probably when you were just starting and I was kind of in my second phase of stand-up. It was like round two. Late 90s. Is that right? When did you get started?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I came to the city in the 90s and started dabbling around, 96, 97 probably. And exactly. Catch a Rising Star used to do those great new freshly squeezed talent, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I forgot that name.
And you were the pro. You were like the big, you were there from the very beginning of my career, actually. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And you introduced yourself and you said, hey, I'm Michael Somerville. And we exchanged emails. It was kind of like, that's the way when I got here in 91, first guy I met was Jim Gaffigan. We met at Cold Waters on the East Side.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he gave me his email. He was very nice. And it's funny when I talk to him about it now, he's like, I can't believe I was even nice to you, because he was kind of a grumpy guy. You know, like he was never, he was always nice, but he was not a gregarious sort of person.
No,
like
curmudgeon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he did, though. He said, hey, we each watched each other's set. We had like 5 minutes each or something. And I said, oh, you're funny. And he's like, oh, you're funny. Here's my email. You know, what other open mics do you do? I said, I'm really new in the city. This is the only one I've done. And so he said, oh, well, call me. So then I did call him at Gray Advertising, where he worked. And he was like, Jim Gaffigan. And I'm like, hey, it's Tom Shalhoub. We met, and he was like, oh, yeah, I can't talk right now. And he was like, just look up open mics, look it up.
Good luck.
Yes, he wasn't much help. But the thing is, he did give me the email. So I do you know, I can hold that in his favor that he did reach out, you know.
Does it still work, the same email address?
No, that was his AOL address. So I bet it does still work because Jim doesn't throw anything away. And my AOL still works. It's tshaloo at AOL. I still have it, but I don't use it.
I still have mine. Yeah.
But
you paid it forward because that's exactly what you did for me. You were friendly and supportive. And I always say you and Steve Byrne were the two guys that I met that were ahead of me doing better. They, you know, had just been in the game and were so kind and so helpful when I first started. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, you know, the interesting thing is whenever I talk to young comics, they always say, oh, what should I do, this and that? And then I always say, tell people what you want, because in those days when I was, you know, early on, basically you just talk to other comics and you're like, hey, where do you do open mics? You know, so you're all trading information. You're all nice to each other. And then as you go along, that's where the insecurities start to come in. And I can remember times when, like, I was going to China at one point to do a gig, and they said, can you just bring an opener with you? So I'm thinking, oh, who am I going to have open for me in China? And it was John Bush, because he was like a friend of mine. And, you know, and he wouldn't mind opening. Like, he was already headlining clubs, but I didn't feel insecure about being like, hey, Bush, you want to go to China? So, right. You know, so we went to China. But the thing is, there's a lot of comics who you'd be like, well, I'm not going to ask that person because they'd be offended that I, you know, they don't want to open for me. They're my peer, you know?
Right. Right.
And then there was things like,
and also, you're going to China with somebody. You better make sure you like that. It's like a relationship.
I know. You spend a lot of time, right?
I've had a lot of relationships end on vacation. You don't want to go to China with a comic you can't stand.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I went back to China and I took Matt McCarthy, and that was another thing, you know, like, Matt, I was like, would you want to do this? Would you want to open for me in China? He's like, absolutely. So, you know, but these were, you know, I was sharing an office with Matt McCarthy, you know, we were kind of friends. So you don't mind kind of putting that out there. Like someone like Todd Barry, who, you know, after I was already kind of headlining rooms, you get to that point of where nobody asks you to open for them anymore because they think like, oh, well, he's got his career going and he's not going to open for me, you know?
Exactly.
But I told Todd Barry, I said, hey, Todd, just not for nothing, I'd open for you anytime, anywhere, because I just wanted to be around him and I wanted to, you know, work his audience. Like, he has a great, you know, great following.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so he was like, oh, okay, well, you want to come down to DC with me? Yeah, absolutely. You know, so it was kind of like, that's a great example of the guys that I would have work with me, open for me when I was younger, were guys who said, hey, if you don't mind, you know, I wouldn't mind opening for you anytime. And they would put it out there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And it's, if you're working with someone you like, or you want to see, or you enjoy being with, that's, I did that. Oh, I mean, Kevin Meaney was the great Kevin Meaney was in Bananas in New Jersey. It's got to be 6, 7, 8 years ago. I mean, maybe right before. I don't remember what year he passed. But, and I just always, I love that guy. And yeah. I headlined the club. I was already a headliner, but I called the club. I was like, can I feature? Like, I just want to, you know, and they're like, why? Because I just want to see him and meet him and hang with him and work with him.
Yeah.
And, I mean, plus, by the way, it's so much low pressure. When you're used to headlining and you got to carry the show and end the show and do all that, I love featuring now. It's my favorite.
Absolutely.
Give me 2025 where I can slip in some new bits. And 100%. But that's funny you say that, because I don't know if you remember this, but I quote you probably every 4 months to this day, because I asked you what I needed to do as a young comic, a brand new comedian. You had one of my favorite answers of all time that I legitimately do, that I was hoping it would come up today. And here we are. You said to me, I said, what do I have to do? And I always crashed. What about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? And you said one thing. You said, get so funny that they know they're going to make money off of you. And I was like, that's amazing. And I thought about that for years and years and years. And I was like, yeah, just get work. Because it simplified everything. It crystallized it. Just don't worry about that. Don't worry about this. Don't worry about that guy. You just get so good that the industry knows they're going to profit from you. And I was like, yeah. And
that's
really
interesting that you liked that advice, because I think a lot of young guys, if I had said that, they would say, well, a lot of good that does me. Yeah, of course I want to get so funny. You know, that's the whole goal, you know.
Right.
That they would take that as like, that's not what I need. I need to know whose number I can call to, you know,
well, that's
get me on TV.
That's so true, but that still exists, right? But that was what I loved about it. I'm a hard worker. I worked hard in school to get good grades, and then I worked hard to get a good job. I worked at McCann Erickson Advertising, much like Gaffigan, who went into advertising. To me, that made sense. Like, I can control that, you know, because that's what helped me. Like, don't worry about that guy and this thing, and how do I call and how do I backdoor this? It was you work your ass off and you're going to have success. That's basically what you said to me. And that resonated certainly with me. And to your point about who do I call, one of my favorite stories, when I got my first letterman in 2012, I'll never forget this guy, the comic I didn't know that well, but it was like, hey, man, hey, good. How'd you get that letterman? Like, you know, because everyone asks you that all of a sudden. How do I, you know, and yeah. they want.
How'd you get like, that?
Yeah. And how'd you get that? My favorite answer. And it was an absolutely true answer. I started telling this because he pissed me off the way he's like, yeah, you could tell what he wanted. He just wanted, you know. And I said, oh, well, in 1998, I went to an open mic and I met this guy that started, you know, and I just started telling the whole story of how I got letterman in 2012. I met this guy. We kept in touch and we became friends and this and that. And then 2002, he needed a opener. So I went on the road with him. And he was really helpful. And he was just getting so confused going, what do you, I said, how'd you get letterman? You know, last week, 2012. I go, I'm telling you, this is the, and it was the relationships and the building and all the things that led to me getting. And then I drove 600 miles for $50 because I knew the stage time would be good. And then this and that. And, you know, he was like glossing over and getting annoyed with my answer. I'm like, I'm telling you how I got letterman if you really want to know. And that was the point. The answer was 14 years of work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he was like, I'm not going to ask that question to anybody.
Yeah. I think by the end, he really did be like, no, who's the booker? Can I get the number email? And I was like, no. Yeah.
Okay, so let's do it. Let's do the kind of the career recap of the phases. Like I said, I got here in 91. I did Conan in 99. That was my first network TV. Then Comedy Central in the early 2000s. I was able to shoot a special for them, the half hour thing. You know, that's the way I look at my career in phases that way. And then there was another 10 years of, you know, it's like marriage and kids and then opening for Gaffigan for years. Then I got Red Eye in 2014 or 15.
Yeah.
And and that was my broadcasting phase. That's what started it. So I want to kind of go through your phases. I know you kind of look back at the different eras of your career. So late 90s, you're working, you're doing the freshly squeezed talent at Catch. What was the first big break that you think of in your career where things started to change?
You know, they always say, right, there's never one big break. It's a series of little ones, you know, a lot of little opportunities. First of all, yeah. I love the way you call it phases. I've never heard it put that way. When you just said you're in your second, you said your second phase, you just said?
Before? Well, my second phase was when I met you. That was phase two, when I kind of like.
I think a lot of women in the world would call that a phase two. Meeting Michael Somerville was a phase.
Yeah, it's just a phase.
That was a phase.
My phases are this. I'm going to tell you my phases, and then that's why you can kind of like
I want to track them. Yeah.
So it's new comic phase, and that was basically 1991 to 97. Then phase two was when I really started working the clubs more, and I was working with guys like Louis and Geraldo and Attell, you know, alongside those guys for once. Like before, it was always like they were the real pros, and I was still like doing the, you know, the open mics and everything. Yeah. So that was phase two. Phase three was after I got my first TV spot, and then, you know, then Comedy Central, and then phase four was touring with Gaffigan, and then phase five was my broadcasting career. So that's the way I kind of look at it.
That's a heck of a career, by the way. That's a nice progression in terms of phases. Yeah, I like that a lot. I hadn't thought of my career that way. I just failed at something. So
well, look, I'm
going to
give you
else.
Some phases. I'm going to give you some phases. So the phase, there is a phase with where, you know, you're working freshly squeezed talent. Then there was a phase when you were like working like the single dude, like the magazine, you were a contributor to the magazine. When did that happen?
You're right. Okay. So yeah, you're right. I opened up. I was doing a lot of bringer shows like we always do. The advantage I had was I was working for a company. I still had an advertising job, so I could just send out an email blast and get 15, 20 people almost any given night to come from where I work to be like, oh, he's got to bring five. He brought 25. Yeah. So I got stage time a lot that way. But the big jump, I would say, I quit my job in 99. So I started working in advertising in 1994, right out of college. I dabbled and messed around with stand-up, but I was like, it wasn't hard. I had a paycheck, didn't make a lot, but I didn't have to go to the club. So I wasn't hanging in the clubs all night. By 99, I realized I got to dive in. And, you know, not that I was going to go hungry. My family lives in Jersey, but to do stand-up, if you really want to do it, you know, make yourself, don't have that paycheck to rely on, you know, make it so you have to work. Yeah. So that was a big step in 99, quitting my job, got my first job ever outside of having a career. My advertising career was I sent this tape to an entertainment company in Long Island, a tape of my stand-up. They called me within a week. That was when we still mailed VHS tapes. Yeah. And I sent like 100 VHS tapes. This company in Long Island, entertainment company, called me, said, "We got a gig for you. It's at the World Trade Center, of all places, a Christmas party." And I was like, this is amazing. They told me the name of the company, and I was excited. It was a tax company or whatever it was. And I prepped for 3 weeks, just looked this company up, material, all this stuff. I show up at the gig, and they hand me a trunk. And I go, "What is this?" And they go, "That's your costume." I wasn't hired to do stand-up at all. I was going to dance around as an orange bear on the dance floor to try to get these, like, these stuck, like, very conservative people to try to get on the dance. My job was to literally just wear this orange bear costume the whole time and try to get people to come on the dance floor. And so that was a phase. That was
classic. Do you remember the company?
I don't remember. I wonder if I could go back and email my AOL emails and find the old, I don't remember it.
They were always like Entertainment Unlimited or something like that, you know?
I thought you meant the name of the company. No, High Voltage Entertainment.
High Voltage.
High Voltage Entertainment. That's it. And they still exist. They emailed me. They were having like a 20 or 25 year anniversary party or something. They emailed me like a couple of months ago. But I don't know how that defines phase, but that entered my phase of, wow, this is going to work. But I'll never forget, much like I said about your advice to me early on, is I looked at it. I had a moment. I said, I'm going to be the best damn orange dancing bear they've ever seen. And I was sweating. My eyes didn't match the eye holes, so I couldn't even see. I had to like turn my head to the left to see out the eye holes because they're made for like an average person. I'm 6'1". And the neck didn't come down, so you could see my neck the whole time. That the head didn't, you know, it was.
Oh, really?
It was. But everyone was a bunch of accountants, so they weren't. They're like, that guy's insane. And I was sweating. I got dehydrated. But I was a good dancing bear, and I got paid.
That is so funny. I can imagine that they. So you sent them a VHS of your stand-up, but you also included a headshot, and you got the ginger hair and the curly, and they said, this guy's kind of looks like a dancing bear.
I'm getting a bear vibe off of this dude. I've been called that in other circles. That's exactly. But from there, so I entered. I go, okay, here we go. I'll take any gig. And the advantage I had also was, like I said, parents in Jersey, so I could get a car if I needed to. And so that was a big help to my career, because a lot of comics in New York, Greer Barnes had a gig at UConn. He was, and he needed to get there. And so I spread the word that I had a car and I would happily drive anyone anywhere. And I'd pick him up, and it was great. I would pick up Greer. I would pick up whoever needed to go. Jason Steinberg, the manager, loved me and started like getting a shirt. I should look back. I probably got paid $100 to, you know, drive so many miles, but it didn't matter. I just knew I needed stage time to get better. And so that helped me a lot. 2005, I got New Faces in Montreal and Comedy Central Premium Blend. That started to feel like, now, you know, because again, I always worked hard in school to get a good grade. But in this industry, what's your grade? There's no graduation. There's no promotion. You look for those benchmarks. And that in 2005 was what told me, oh, you're doing something right. You're progressing. You're not kidding yourself. You are good. You're funny. You can do well. And then, 2007, I got the job writing for Glamour magazine. I was their dating columnist, Jake, A Man's Opinion. And 2 million women a month, you know, took my advice and wrote to me and asked for. So that was, I guess, another phase. Now you're getting paid and you're in the business and you're really taking off. The next year I got my TV show Wingmen. Now you're like, okay, I'm doing this. But then by 2009, everything got canceled. I lost all those jobs and I sublet my apartment in New York and moved back home with my parents because all the jobs were gone. So that was
the magazine job was gone. The not Wise Guys. What is it? Wingman.
Wingman. Yeah. Yep.
And what was that on? What network?
That was FLN. Fine Living Network was a cable station. They wanted to rebrand, call themselves FLN, and be younger and hipper and start to do more stuff. Like, it was a dating reality show where I was the wingman, the expert who would help people, singles looking for love. Yeah. And they had a closet organizing show. They had a bunch of different shows. They were trying to make themselves cool. And I was one of the marquee shows that they launched, that new season, new channel. And not only did the show get canceled, but the entire network went out of business. So, I mean, I take entire networks down. I didn't just get canceled. The whole thing went belly up. And same thing with the writing job at Glamour. They usually do about 3 years, and then they switch writers. So that 3 years went up, and they renewed my contract every year for 3 years, and then that was over. I was dating a wonderful woman. That ended. I went from feeling like, this is it. I've got it all going. It's just a matter of who wants me next. And then next thing I know, I was living with my parents back in Jersey.
Wow, 2009. So that is a definite, the end of a phase right there.
Well, that's why I say my phases feel like they just ended failures. And then I go, all right, what else can I do now?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny because we gloss over, like, I feel like there were definite dips in, in my stand-up career where I was kind of Nowheresville for a while, but then I would, I'd get out and maybe do, because I was always running around doing advertising, voiceovers and commercials, and you did commercials as well, right? Because I would see with the auditions.
Yeah, well, no one did them as well as you and as much as you, but yeah, you definitely, I got a couple ones that floated me.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, you can... Sometimes you're like, oh, I guess, 6 months goes by and you're just doing that. And I didn't have anything on the stand up front. And you're like, oh, I guess I'm a voiceover guy now. You know what I mean? Like that's what, and then that kind of would fade away and I wouldn't have any voiceovers, but then maybe I'd book an on camera thing. And, that would go for a while. So you have these little, moments that you plateau at.
Yeah.
And then you think like, well, is it, and then the internet comes in. And you're like, now this is 2009. So people are starting to, was Dane Cook a thing back then, 2009?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it was starting to be that internet of things with comedy where guys were like making a living now doing, I mean, they weren't quite making a YouTube living yet, but they would establish a website and they use their outreach on social media or, what was the early days of social media, MySpace and things like that to kind of sell out rooms or, get some heat in the clubs. Were you doing that when you moved back home? Did you kind of hit the road? Did you go out and start playing more clubs?
That's exactly what I did. And I was a Chris Rock interview when he got fired from Saturday Night Live. He never felt quite comfortable at Saturday Night Live and he didn't know what to do. So he just decided to hit the road and just pound it out as a stand-up. And that's exactly what I took that to heart. I said, that's the one thing I can control. That's the thing I know that I'm good at. The industry is unpredictable, but I can write and perform. And that's what I decided to do. And again, going all the way back to your advice, just to get so good that they can't say no. And that's what I've done every phase of my career. Whenever push comes to shove, I go, well, let's go do stand up. And creatively it's fulfilling, I mean, I'll fast forward to this past month here. I'm home and now I'm married with one baby and a second on the way. So I have not done nearly as much traveling or writing or anything but it's the one thing that I sit down and go, I'm going to write some jokes. I'm going to go to club tonight and tell them. And that at least I feel relevant,
Where do you live?
In Manhattan, in New York City, right over Hudson Yards over on the west side, that new development with the Edge and all that, so the Vessel, all that new stuff.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so yeah. Hudson Yards. And do you still have the car?
Have a car, yes. Yeah. Well, don't have my parents' car now. Once we had the baby, we got a car. We got the wife. I got the whole package.
You got the wife. How old's the baby number one?
18 months.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, thank you. And then the next one's due in September.
Oh, this is the best. Yeah. This is going to be the best phase of life. It's going to be unbelievable. You're already in it. You're in the phase. You're not even going to remember this, though. Like when your kids are like 8 and 10, you and your wife are going to sit down and you're going to be like, what were we doing then? Like, what did we do? Like, did we go to the movies? Did we have dinner? And it's like, I don't think we did that for several years, you know?
I can see that being true. Yep. We go to bed literally the moment we can. Like tonight, yeah. I don't have a show. She's going to come home and we'll put the baby down at 7:30. She's like, let's be in bed by like 8. I'm like, absolutely.
Oh, incredible.
What do you want to watch? Nothing. Just, yeah. But how old are your kids?
Almost 18 and almost 15. So
are you kidding
17
me?
And 14.
Holy cow. Oh yeah. Gosh, it goes fast, huh?
Yeah. It's ridiculous. And it's, you know, yeah. You know, you've heard it, you hear it over and over again. And then when the kids are small and you're taking them to, you know, to Bubby's for breakfast and, you know, you're doing the brunch and the babies are crawling on the floor, people are like, this goes fast. Enjoy it. And you're like, yeah, I get it. You know what I mean? Like you just hear that cliche over and over, but it's so true. And part of it is that it's so traumatic and the lack of sleep and the concern for your kids and the exhaustion and everything, it all kind of adds up to be like, it's like in memory holes so quickly.
I believe it. And, you know, and I'm older, obviously, as a dad. And so I've heard so many stories and I've heard other comics talk about being a dad, plus the advice in general of it goes fast. I'm trying so hard to embrace that and to be aware and be present, be in the moment and not complain. And it's hard to do, though. You know, you're tired. There's a lot of moving parts. And but I am trying to like, nope, enjoy it, because God knows I've been hearing it for 25 years from every one of my friends who has a kid. You know, they've all got their stuff. So I'm doing my best, but I'm tired.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what's funny is when your older parents like we are. I mean, my first daughter was born when I was 40, so that's always the barometer for me. You know, when I can always remember how old I am.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm 17 years older than 40. That's how old I am.
It's a good way of, yeah, to carry the one. Like, oh God, all right.
Yeah. But life goes faster as you get older. So I think if you have kids when you're 20, you know, your life is still just kind of cooking along in second gear there, but like it's racing faster and faster. So yeah. When you have kids in your 40s, your life is going fast anyway because you're getting old. And then your life is going fast because you have children. So it's like double fast.
That's exactly the way I feel, you know. And I do a joke that it has not worked because it just makes audiences sad. But I go, they say it goes fast. And for me, the stakes are even higher because as this baby's growing, I'm dying. And, and people do not like the joke and it hasn't done well in the clubs. But it's so true, you know.
This is. I think Seinfeld had a thing, you know, about his kids. He's like, you know, we're the idea that we're on our way out, you know, and the kids are reminding us this. And he says, "What's the first thing they learn to say? Bye bye, Dada. Bye bye, Dada."
it's true. It's well, and this stuff hits me more now. Like I didn't care. I always liked kids. I always see you kids. I wanted kids, but there's a clip of Modern Family going around where, you know, the Al Bundy guy, what's his name? The grandpa, he's just talking about
Al Bundy was in that. He was in
Modern Family, the guy who plays Al Bundy, you know, what's the grandpa in Modern Family?
Oh, so wait, Al Bundy is a different show than Modern Family though, right? Al Bundy was the
Al Bundy was Married with Children.
Married with Children. Yeah. And he was in, I didn't know, cause I've never seen O'Neil. Modern Family, but he plays the grandpa in that.
Ed O'Neill. Yes. Okay. He plays the grandpa. I call him Al Bundy to this day, but it's a clip going around, you know, and it's basically talking about the phases, to use today's word, of, you know, for you have this kid, just this amazing kid, and all of a sudden the baby gets older and now she's a toddler, and you know, that phase is over and you miss that early phase, but now it's a new phase and you keep getting replaced. So these new phases are the incredible thing. And then they turn 18, they walk out, all those kids walk out the door and they're gone. And stuff like that, I would just swipe. I don't even look. I start bawling. I'm looking at my phone, just start crying. I cry probably 4 times a day because of Instagram and TikTok videos that somehow reference a child growing up or getting older or the intimate moments. And I've become a big puddle of mush here.
Yeah. Did you get it? You don't have a dog yet, do you?
Don't have a dog, and I've fought that one. I'm actually allergic to animal hair, and they keep going, well, hypoallergenic, all that other stuff. But I'm like, I already do everything here. My wife works a lot, so I am cooking, cleaning, doing the laundry. I do everything. I'm like, there's no way I'm taking a dog out at 5 or 6 in the morning. Also, this, I'm not doing it. But I'm also, we're living in the city still. You know, the whole suburb thing is the, with number 2 coming. How does that go? So there's a lot of questions to be answered.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go to the my question here about, you were in the same apartment for the foolishness, as I don't like to even call it the pandemic. I call it the foolishness.
Oh, I thought the foolishness. I thought you meant you were referring to the night that we made the baby. No. Yeah. that's what she calls it. we were. So we had just moved in. I met her in 2018. Moved in rather quickly in 2019 to an apartment together, to live together before we got married. And then, yeah, we were in a one bedroom throughout the pandemic with really no place to go. We didn't have, you know, didn't have a second home or anywhere we could escape to. So she worked from home during the pandemic and I sat in the bedroom all day. It was
rough.
Holy
cow.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was
unbelievable. And you survived. I mean, that's great. Cause that was a breaking point for a lot of people.
100%. I mean, it was a lot of couples didn't, and we actually, I would argue, got stronger. I mean, I think it really helped our relationship. We spent a lot of time together. Obviously, we got on each other's nerves, but overall, like, I really was like, yeah, she's great. She was very chill. She's not, she's easy to get along with. She doesn't like confrontation. For a tough time during everyone's lives, we did well. So that was good. And I proposed during the pandemic, and we got married during the pandemic here in New York City, which is a little like prison love. I mean, just, I was like, will you marry me? She's like, I don't know anyone else. We made it. And we still are in the same, we upgraded. We got a 2-bedroom apartment now, because, which, by the way, I don't know how many times have you had your own room in your life? I had 2 older brothers growing up. I've never had my own room. We just moved so the baby could have her own room. I was like,
it's unbelievable.
What? The baby's this big.
Yeah, we had, I mean, we were in Brooklyn and then we went to Manhattan and we had a 1-bedroom down in the financial area.
Yeah.
That's when we had our first daughter. Okay. And then, of course, she's just a baby. So she's in the room with us.
Right.
And so that was great. And then we moved up to Riverdale We had a 2-bedroom. And then had another baby. So, of course, the baby's staying with us. And then Agnes had her own room. And then we moved into another apartment there in Riverdale, like a little co-op. And the kids shared a room. That was great. They had the bunk beds.
Okay.
And then we moved up to here, up to Westchester in Bronxville. And we got a house in Bronxville just before the pandemic. I'm so glad we got out of that apartment.
Because
apartment living, very difficult during the pandemic.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Did your neighbors drive you crazy? Were they like, you know, were people in the hallway, like, you know, avoiding you, the masky people walking around the building and all that kind of stuff?
Certainly was the masks. There was, we were very lucky. We had a little outdoor space, like a little terrace space that we could kind of out of private. So it was, yeah. So we actually were able to be like, all right, we can step outside. But yeah, of course, it was washing of groceries and masks and, you know, all the rules. We weren't allowed to have visitors. I mean, the building had a rule that no one else but people who live here are allowed to come over. And you just couldn't have a friend over, which I was like, is that legal? Are they allowed to do that? But
All sorts of absolutely illegal, unconstitutional, immoral things just happened. And everyone's just like, oh, that's what has to happen.
That's it. Now, the only upside I would say would be New York City street drinking. Everyone, those bars opened and you could get beers to go, and they were supposedly to take home, but everyone would just walk around like it was Mardi Gras. And so that's what my wife and I wound up doing. Like on the weekend, we're like, let's go get a bar. And then we'd get like 20,000 steps because we would just walk around the city and sip our margarita. And there wasn't a whole heck of a lot to do. I'm surprised we didn't make a baby then, but yeah.
You were practicing, I'm sure.
Whenever I was allowed. The foolishness.
Yeah. Yes.
The foolishness.
But we were so lucky because we moved up here and then we have this homeschool community it's like a kind of a Catholic homeschool group, and none of them fell for the foolishness. So we were able to have all these friends. We ignored all COVID rules. We got together. We would go to parties, sneeze in each other's faces. Our children played together. We would rip the tape down at the playground. And we even rented a summer camp because the summer camps were closed. So during that first year, they didn't have anything, even with the mask or the whatever crazy rules.
Right.
They just canceled summer camp for the whole summer. So there was a camp up in upstate New York and we rented it and
amazing.
We all went there and just, had partied around the fire. The kids played games in the swimming pool. They did the climbing wall, all without any restrictions because it was a private endeavor, you know?
Oh, that's unbelievable. I wish I had called you.
I know. We would have had you put that bear costume on and
come entertain the kids. Well, and that was the thing. I was in New York and you're just seeing all right, everyone go home. Everyone do. I'm like, all right. I went to 8 years of Catholic school. I'll listen. I'll follow the rules. And then I would start doing, I did occasionally a gig. I would fly to like Florida once and another one was Alabama or somewhere. And it was just like, no one was wearing masks. I was at a casino in, I think it was Alabama. And I was wearing my mask. I was like, yeah, that's what, we'll go to the show with the mask on, take it off, perform, put it back. And no one in the casino was wearing the mask. And this one woman was like, what's with the mask? Like, what do you, she hadn't gotten the news yet. And that was the first insight I had to like, oh, wow, the whole country's not doing this.
Yes.
Like, it's just us in New York being, it's like the whole country got grounded, but some, like, with stricter parents in some states or something. Yeah. And yeah, I wish I'd known because and now it's like, you see it sometimes, like they're coming back and everyone's like, really? Are we really going to start doing that again? Why? Because the election's coming up or is that what we're doing? Or
I think so. They may try to do that for the fall because that's going to be flu season anyway. People will start getting it. So I'm sure they're going to try to do some things, but they'll never be able to do that again. Nah. That's why I call it the foolishness. It was just such a mass hysteria and such nonsense. And I think there's a lot of people, obviously, who still buy into it. You see people who are ready to kind of go back, but
some people never came out.
Yeah. But it's now I don't think anyone's going to fall for that again. You couldn't do it again. Yeah. You had about, I guess, like you said, a lot of parts of the country, if you went to parts of Florida, Alabama, Texas, whatever, you could see that people weren't in the hysteria. America's cities obviously were into it. But even then, it was only half of the people. Now, I think 60% of the country would never fall for that nonsense again.
You'd have a tough time getting people to, exactly. I mean, from the education, kids who missed years of education and development. And I mean, having a baby now, I look at just the development and the interaction with other kids. I can't imagine if you weren't allowed to go near anyone and, I mean, the stalled, you'd have a tough time convincing people to do anything like that again, I think, right? But, memories are short. Who knows, 40 years from now or, I don't know, 100 years from now? I didn't mean to get sad.
No, it's, this is what, I was ready to go, like, to completely go, like, Unabomber, except without bombing people, get the cabin completely cut off from the grid.
Yeah.
I was done with society. It was such a disappointment. I mean, it still is. And it's still, I used to actually believe in our culture. I believed that we would never, I remember going when I told you I went to China. When I went to China, there were people with masks on in, 2007 or something.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, oh, well, that would never happen in this country. We would never do that because we value human interaction too much. We are a social culture. We need to see faces,
Right.
And we would never cover our faces. We used to make fun of people in the Islamic world for all their face coverings. Then we went worse than them. I mean, they never even covered their actual faces.
True. Well, that you used to see that here in sometimes the Chinese that would come to New York too, right? And they would wear the mask, but that was for pollution, though, right? Isn't that their reason over there? Like initially,
yeah, pollution, and also they would, like they said, like during the pandemic, Asian countries they've been masking for years. Certain people, it's so crowded on their subways and everything like that. People would wear masks when they went to work, and because of the pollution as well,
right.
But the there's something inhuman about covering the face, and when everyone just kind of bought into it, and I would not do that. And then people would yell at me, like I would be out walking the streets, and then the crazy paranoid people would start pointing at me, yelling "mask," like invasion of the body snatchers.
Oh my god, yeah.
And
yeah.
I never had one of those meltdowns in a CVS, but I liked the people who had those meltdowns.
Yeah.
You know, like I wish more people were having meltdowns. Yeah. So I really like, I kind of went into semi-retirement and I was just, you know, painting watercolors and, you know.
Were you really?
Yeah. What's that?
You started painting watercolors and
I was painting watercolor. I was doing music on my own, trying to teach myself some more music and I was thinking like, well, maybe we can just downsize. We'll because New York is a total joke. The civil liberties are completely gone. Maybe we'll sell the house. We'll go to someplace in the woods. I do have friends that live out in rural areas and would go visit them in their cabin and things like that. And I was thinking like, this world has lost its mind and it's no longer, I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to be a part of a world where people have face coverings. I don't want to be a part of a world where people are living in a forced injections and things like that. I don't want it, but it's not like I could move to Ireland. Ireland was worse.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know, Canada was worse.
Yeah.
The US was actually not as bad as a lot of countries. Yeah. So I was just thinking like, okay, I'm going to stay in the US, but I'm ready to completely check out and just, find a community of preppers, get myself my ham radio and some, learn how to shoot my own meat, that kind of thing.
I talk about a reality show I would watch. Tom Shalhoub in the wild.
Yeah. I know. It actually would be a good show because I talk such a tough game, but in the end it would be like Mr. Rogers goes hunting,
You got from water painting or watercolors to killing your own meat. There was an episode of Cheers, one of my favorite all-time shows, where Frasier does that, brings Lilith to like a cabin in the woods and decides he's gonna be man and make fire from scratch, and within 2 hours they've got a reservation back in Boston. Yeah.
yes
But I think you could do it if you want. I will watch that show if you make it.
Yeah. Well, we may have to go there at some point, but for now we wrote it out. I actually did live gigs with Gutfeld as best as we could. You probably did this as well. You'd go to some gigs and the restrictions would be more than others. We did a lot of outdoor shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we started playing drive-in theaters and then a lot of the Gutfeld crowd and the Red State people, they would flaunt the rules. Even when we played the outdoor shows, they would ask people to still wear masks and people would just laugh and just, but then we'd go to Cape Cod, and Cape Cod, Massachusetts, very locked down. Like they actually enforce the outdoor masks in Massachusetts.
Wow, man. Oh man.
What an insane
time. That really, yeah. Yeah, and like you say, I'm not sure we're out of it, or at least they're not going to try to bring some of that back, especially when it comes to votes.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be crazy, but I got to keep a good humor about it. That's why I love the Gutfeld gig, because I mean, I'm on a cable news channel and I do other shows. I just did the big weekend show this week on there. So I co-host that, and it's news, it's cable news, but I'd much rather just do like a Joe Biden impression and then just move on.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Which I do enjoy very much. I love your impression, by the way.
Thank you. Well, and I can shoot it from home a lot. I mean, a lot of times I shoot it from my living room, cause that's the habit we got into during the pandemic. I would shoot them at home and I can control it. I like it so much better than when you go in and you have writers write out the bit and then you shoot it, so you can, there's something good about that because you have a crew working with you and you kind of just do it and get it done. But at home I can do it and then I can refine it,
Exactly. Make it exactly what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I've found that with auditions too. And they're like, just tape yourself at home. I'm like, great. I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to, this is wonderful. But then I do spend probably 10 times longer working on it. Cause you're just like, oh, it's not done. It's not enough, you know? But I do love it. I just, to be able to do this stuff from home is fabulous. I thought for a while, I thought they'd never be a live guest on a talk show again. When they, you know, remember they were doing all those remotes. I'm like, well, if you don't have to fly from LA to New York to promote a movie, why would you? But that's all back. And I think that's a good thing. Cause to your point, interactive face to face, you know, that's human beings. That's what we need.
It's human. But, and here we are, we're doing the essentially doing the Zoom, but.
Well, you're off in the woods somewhere, so I can't. Yeah, I couldn't find you if I wanted to.
Westchester County, come on. well, that's great. Hopefully we'll get to, maybe we'll do some stand-up together at some point.
I would love, you know, that.
We should keep in touch about that. I just did City Winery about a month ago. I've been doing my solo show. I wrote a show about my family, my parents, and I've been kind of doing that around.
Oh, and I would love to come see that. Are you playing it somewhere in New York?
I'll probably do it in New York again, whether it's at City Winery or maybe find a nice theater space to do it. Because it's kind of, it's a theater show, but okay. I'll do it in the clubs because it's, as you know, it's much easier to book a club than a theater.
Sure.
Because they kind of do all the work for you. I just went to Boston to play Laugh Boston. Yeah. And, you know, they have built-in marketing there, and they have an audience mailing list, and, you know, just you do a show there, the booker books it, you show up, and then the audience shows up. But when you play theaters, you really got to kind of turn out every person on your own.
It's a bringer show, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. All the way back to the bringers. Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. The club. Well, please. By all means, I would love to come see it. Yeah. And I mean, and obviously always open for you whenever needed.
I love it. And we got to do some, I mean, you used to do Red Eye, but you haven't done any Fox stuff in a while. Am I right about that? Or did you do Fox News Saturday Night?
No, I haven't been really on anything since you. I did your show there a couple of times, right? We came in and did some radio after Red Eye, but no, I hadn't been back since. Yeah, you're my only my only in.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, yeah. I'll keep it though. I'm gonna hold that over you.
Please do.
Well, that's great. This was great talking to you, and I want to see that baby. I want to see the new baby. I want to meet your wife, you know. So we got to do that at some point.
I would love that, man. I'm in New York City more than ever these days. So let me know if you ever come down, and I'll talk to you offline because I'd love to come see your show.
Absolutely.
Cheers.
All righty, Michael Somerville, everybody. We'll see you later.
Thanks, brother.